Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer has announced his retirement. Coming up actually in about 6 months, but of course the race is on to find out who is going to replace him. And of course, conservatives are already freaking out about those prospects. And Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz has had a really horrible week, and we're going to talk about why it's probably going to get much worse for him as we move forward. And Shahid Buttar, who is challenging Nancy Pelosi for her seat in Congress that she has held since 1987, is going to be here to talk not just about his campaign, but about how politicians need to get back to working for the public. And writer Sohail Mortazavi is going to join me to talk about cryptocurrencies and why he believes they're all just a giant Ponzi scheme. If you want the full show, make sure you go to rofpodcast.com, become a member and help support us, and check us out on YouTube. Fresh content every day of the week, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. So one of the biggest stories, obviously this week, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer announced his retirement. Now, of course, the retirement does not go into effect for about 6 months, so we have until summer before Breyer is officially off of the court. Nevertheless, we are already getting tons and tons of speculation about who could possibly fill that seat. Of course, Republicans, they're not only freaking out about the prospects, but they're also pushing some kind of wild conspiracies about what could happen. They're talking about maybe he's going to put Vice President Kamala Harris on the court and then appoint Hillary Clinton as his VP, and then all of this wildness that would take place from that. Yeah, that's not going to happen. They're also talking about, maybe it's Michelle Obama, maybe it's Barack Obama. Also things that are not going to happen. But most importantly, Biden has announced that he wants to put a black woman on the Supreme Court, which, of course, would be the first black female Supreme Court justice. We've only had two African-American justices so far throughout history, Thurgood Marshall, Clarence Thomas, and Biden wants to have a third. And of course, he wants it to be a woman because, believe it or not, representation does, in fact, matter. Life experiences matter. And that is something that you don't get if you put another crusty old white man on that court. And that is why this is important. I know a lot of people don't like to talk about the race issues. They don't like to talk about the gender issues. They want to say, well, he should just put the most qualified person on there. And he should. But there's no reason why the most qualified person can't also be a black woman. Again, life experiences do in fact matter in these particular circumstances. They hear issues about race and gender all the time at the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's better to get a decision from someone who has lived experience. That's what we need on that court right now. So I fully support and endorse this administration's decision to put a black woman on that court. I think that's a great idea. I think equal, or at least better, because it certainly wouldn't be equal, but better representation on that court of what the United States actually looks like. We do not have that right now at all. Never have. And it's time that we get to that. And it's that point right there, by the way, that Republicans are freaking out about. You know, Tomi Lahren went on Fox News and whined about the prospect of a black woman on the court. Pretty much every other show on Fox News and every other conservative pundit was also wringing their hands, freaking out about a black woman on the court. And it just shows you the level of really just racism and misogyny that comes out of that political party. That is what they peddle in. And of course, they're using it to stoke fear in their base. That's what they do. That's the only thing they have to run on. So that's a little bit about the freak out there. And of course, we also have to talk about the fact that you have people like Dianne Feinstein, you know, Democrat senator, who says, yeah, there's no rush, right? We've got all the time in the world to figure out who is going to take over the seat. And that's just absolutely preposterous. We do not have all the time in the world, assuming Republicans don't, you know, try to delay this as much as possible. Of course, filibuster rules have been weakened to a degree for Supreme Court nominees, so that works in Biden's favor now. But we don't have time, especially since we're coming up on midterms. You know, if this had been a year ago, we'd have all the time in the world, right? There wouldn't be that much of a rush. But with midterms and Republicans poised to make big gains, we don't have all the time, because if Republicans retake the Senate and then that new Senate convenes next January, we're not getting a Supreme Court justice placed. We will have a vacancy for at least 2 years. That's what will happen. So there is this feeling of urgency here. And of course, we cannot confirm somebody to the court until Breyer is officially gone, but we can start the shortlist. We can start the vetting process. We can basically have this nominee ready to go, ready to be voted on in the Senate, where you only need, you know, a majority vote. So it'd be 51. We can have that ready to go the day that Breyer packs up his desk and gets out of that office. And that, to me, is probably the most important thing. Another big thing that happened this week is that Matt Gaetz, Republican congressman from my district right here in Florida, is in a lot of hot water, I guess. I think that's the easiest way to say it. You know, we did have major news breaking this week that another, I guess you would call him an ally of Matt Gaetz, has pleaded guilty to several crimes, not related, for the record, to anything that Matt Gaetz is being investigated for. This individual is a former shock jock here in the state of Florida, that was working alongside Joel Greenberg as part of his scheme, basically the pay-to-play bribery schemes. And that's what took this man, Joe Ellicott, down. And that's, of course, what he pleaded guilty to. But as part of his plea deal, he has agreed, of course, to hand over and cooperate in any way possible in any ongoing investigation, not just investigation into his criminal matters, but any investigation. They made sure to put that stipulation into that plea agreement. It says it doesn't matter if it's not related to what you did. You're going to cooperate. And then, of course, the bomb dropped. Ellicott says that he was in the room when Joel Greenberg phoned Matt Gaetz to tell him that the woman they had both had sexual relationships with was in fact underage. That, to a degree, could be the smoking gun in this entire investigation. Now, I explained this in a video on our YouTube channel, and I want to explain it again here in case anybody hasn't seen that. But this admission from Ellicott is huge, and it can also mean absolutely nothing. And here's why. In the investigation part of this, Ellicott's admission that he was there when the phone call took place and this is what was said, these were the reactions and all of that, that's great and wonderful. It certainly gives investigators something to go on. But if he doesn't have more evidence, you know, physical evidence that this happened, it's hearsay. That is how that would be described. So that doesn't give investigators a whole heck of a lot, of course, unless he does have the evidence to provide to them to show that this did in fact happen. So in the investigation, it gives them a new lead, it gives them a new avenue to look at, and it could, of course, corroborate stories that may have been told to them by Joel Greenberg himself. But it doesn't really give us much to go on with the investigation. However, the part where it does come into play in a fairly big way is with the trial. If criminal charges are filed against Matt Gaetz, then Ellicott could be called to the stand where he could tell that story, and that testimony would carry more weight than it would telling it just to the investigators. So again, it's a big, big development, and it also doesn't mean very much right now unless this thing results in criminal charges and goes to trial. So that's what's happening with Matt Gaetz. And of course, about 2 weeks ago, his ex-girlfriend was given immunity in exchange for testifying against him. The guy is having a really rough year so far. And based on the way things are already playing out, doesn't look like his year is going to get any better. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced this week that she is officially not going to retire and instead will be seeking maybe her 19th term in Congress this week. But I am joined now by Shahid Buttar, who actually ran a very promising campaign against Nancy Pelosi last time. He is running for office again. Shahid, thank you for joining me today. I loved your campaign back in 2020. I'm fully, even though I'm on the opposite side of the country, behind you with this run right here. And I do have to start by saying, listen, polls came out this week, Congress 18% approval rating, okay? We're looking at an 18% approval rating. Nancy Pelosi has been in office since 1987. January 1987, she came into office. I was 4 years old, actually almost 4 years old. I'm pushing 40 now. That's how long Nancy Pelosi has been in office. And we see this all the time. You know, nobody likes Congress, and yet they continuously go back to the polls every 2 years and they say, well, my person's okay. No, we need a sea change. And I think that that's absolutely what you represent here.
I appreciate that. And thank you so much for having me on. I agree certainly with everything you suggested about the longevity of the incumbent's career and the need for change. I want to dial it up a little bit. It's not just the case that she's been in office since 1987 and that the rule of our gerontocracy, the rule of octogenarians, is racing our species off a climate cliff. All that is true. She hasn't debated a single challenger the entire time she has been in office.
Wow.
So over the course of your life that she has been a public servant, she's been ducking debates. And I invite your listeners to think about who gets to go 34 years without ever having a job evaluation. And that's what a debate is. She relies on the press to construct a false image of her to the public. If the public had any idea what her policy record was, her public image could not survive. But the press lacks the independence to ask hard questions. And since she ducks debates, nobody ever hears the actual facts. And I'm eager. The only reason I ran is because I know the facts too well. And I've been watching the train wreck of the last 20 years in slow motion as a nonprofit leader and a public interest advocate. I've worked in national nonprofit organizations, both in San Francisco and in Washington. I've led organizations. And the entire time I've been doing that work, particularly defending constitutional rights from predatory policing and surveillance, the entire time I've been doing that work, I've watched Nancy Pelosi side time and time again on one issue from the next, from healthcare to student debt relief, war, militarism, rent and mortgage relief, bailing out banks, tax breaks for the wealthy, freezing the minimum wage. She has always sided with Wall Street and the Pentagon against we the people of the United States, and certainly against we the people of San Francisco. And I love my city too much. I love my country too much. And I think I adore the future too much that we all share to sit on my hands and defer to the gerontocracy that threatens humanity. And ultimately, I'm running as an act of both international and intergenerational solidarity. I'm especially proud of having forced Pelosi to cave on six major issues over the last 2 years. And I'm eager to see what else we can win by way of policy until we push her out of her seat. There's a bunch of different things we could talk about here in terms of the dynastic succession plan that she seems to be working to build and any of the policy issues. And I'm happy to dig into all that.
Well, I think, not to just constantly dig on Pelosi, but we do have to talk about obviously one of the bigger things that's happened recently, her insistence just a couple weeks ago that, oh, it's totally okay for members of Congress to trade stock. It's a free market system. We're allowed to participate. And then after massive public backlash for such a tone deaf statement, she now is warming up. I can't even say she's behind, but she's warming up to maybe making that a little look. This is an individual whose net worth has gone from, non-existent to well over $100 million since she's been in office. Okay. And she is married. Obviously her husband has some financial interests too. So that helps with the net worth thing, but nobody should go into Congress, not a millionaire, and leave Congress with over $100 million. I mean, they shouldn't become millionaires from being in Congress unless they found a way to not have to spend any of their paychecks. But this is obscene. And I think everybody listening or watching here, they should be able to understand that, no, that's not normal. That's not what we send these people to Washington to do. And we sure as hell don't send them to Washington to defend their right to make as much money as possible while ignoring what's happening back home.
Absolutely. And the only two places I'd push back, first is it's entirely too normal. That's exactly the problem, is that everybody in Congress is doing this. And I want to dig into what this is and how bad it is in a minute. The only caveat I want to draw is that Pelosi was, and I think this actually proves your point, she was a millionaire before she went to Congress. She was chosen for Congress because she was a millionaire who was a skilled Democratic Party fundraiser. That was her only qualification, was the fact that she was wealthy. And then she went from being a millionaire to becoming a mega millionaire. Her fortune is now pushing $200 million. And it was built, this is the key, at the public's expense. There's a constitutional prohibition, the Emoluments Clause. It was the clause that could have brought Trump down had it been included in any of the impeachment processes that Pelosi affirmatively limited to keep it off the table because she is up to, as we've discovered, her neck in it. Now, here's the part I want to emphasize. It's not just members of Congress trading stock. When we talk about congressional insider trading, we're talking about the corruption of two different things at once, both the marketplace and Congress. The reason it corrupts the marketplace is because you can't have a free market when some people in the market are trading based on information that they only have access to. That's why we have insider trading laws that constrain, for instance, executives at companies from doing what every member of Congress is doing at the moment, right? Across both parties, this is a bipartisan corruption that has set in. Now, that's just the corruption of the marketplace. I am frankly more concerned about the corporate corruption of Congress through conflicts of interest introduced when members of Congress are now evaluating policy. They're making policy not just based on the disproportionate preponderance of corporate lobbyists who are beating down their doors, you know, relative to the one or two nonprofit people who, you know, we the people have the resources to send to counter them, right? Not only are they hearing this disproportionate influence from lobbyists, but they have financial interests in the outcome. You have members of Congress who swear oaths to serve the public, but they're serving their stock portfolios first. That's why they've never even seen a vote in the House on the universal health care long enjoyed by the citizens of every industrialized country across planet Earth. And we in the United States uniquely spend vast, on the order of orders of magnitude more resources on weapons than any other country, while we deny our people health care and medicine in the middle of a global pandemic. And these are the questions that get baked in the sauce through the conflicts of interest introduced when we allow members of Congress to trade stock. Now, here's the further point I want to make. This was never okay. It became a controversy in the last few weeks because some journalist finally asked her about it. I've been beating this drum for years. And this is just the tip of an iceberg. The corruption in Washington extends so much deeper than just insider trading. It ranges on everything from the abdication of human rights, which we could press on, to self-enrichment in other ways. This corruption is the issue, and it's why we need to change the leadership. And frankly, we should expect this kind of corruption when we let people stay in office for 30 years without ever showing up for a job evaluation. And I dare say that we the people deserve better than that. And I do hope that my neighbors demand it.
Well, you know, and we also, not necessarily Pelosi, but so many others too, they're all starting podcasts right now instead of legislating like they're supposed to, and they can put these things on YouTube and monetize that way. I mean, Washington, D.C. right now, and again, you see this with both parties tremendously, it's a giant cash cow. Do what you can, make a name for yourself. You get to have your super PACs, and then you get to do all kinds of weird financial things with those. And sometimes you can get your money. Sometimes you have to get it. It's so gross, the amount of money flowing in and out of all of these individuals from corporations, from each other, paying, you know, campaign to campaign. And with Ted Cruz now, his case in front of the Supreme Court that could increase the limits or abolish the limits on how much you can get reimbursed from your campaign. My God, it is a massive just cash cow for anybody who wants to sell their soul effectively to go to D.C. to make all this money. And no part of me thinks that you are like that at all. And that's what I love about you. That's what I love about your campaign. And like I said, I've got your website right in front of me here on all these issues. I can't find anything that I'm disagreeing with you on. And that is not only exceptionally rare, but I think it's a very good testament to how good you are on these issues. And again, I don't say that lightly. I mean, even Bernie Sanders, who I really liked, didn't agree 100% on everything. There was plenty of things where I said, no, I'm different here. But I am struggling, and I always try to find, but I am struggling to find something here that I say, no, I think this is a bad idea. So let's just put it this way. You get to office. What's priority number one? What's the big issue that you feel we've got to tackle first?
Well, I'd say the big issue and the one to tackle first aren't necessarily the same, but the very first issue to tackle is universal health care. We are living in a pandemic that has killed almost 1 million Americans. And this is a point that has evaded the public discussion about the pandemic. The amount of medical debt that is being incurred across the country is staggering. And I've actually been asking researchers and journalists, you know, if anybody's seen more precise numbers. The latest I've seen suggests that the amount of medical debt was over $17 billion a few weeks ago, and I think it's growing since then. But I'm particularly eager to discover how much it's burdening families. And I gather that the average ICU stay is over $100,000. And even the average COVID diagnosis is costing people tens of thousands of dollars. It's not just long COVID and the health symptoms and the people that we're unfortunately losing to this, you know, brutal disease. Many people who are surviving are going to be indebted for their lives. Only in the United States, because uniquely among industrialized countries, we deny the basic human right to healthcare. That to me is the most pressing exigency. The biggest issue in my mind is shrinking the Pentagon. It's the gateway to any number of things because it's both how our resources are co-opted in the service of death, misery, and destruction around the world, the contrivance of future national security problems. Don't forget that Al-Qaeda owes its roots to the CIA when they trained him as the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, right? We have a habit of investing massive sums in weapons and training our future adversaries, and that cycle has to stop. Human rights matter first, and the military-industrial complex is not just a hole in the federal budget. It is an engine for human rights abuses and climate catastrophe across the world, and that's the big issue. If I can just throw another one on the table, the most sort of visionary one, the one that I think Congress, no one in Congress is proposing this. It is absolutely the thing that we should be talking about, is nationalizing the fossil fuel industry. As long as we allow through the property regime, people and corporations particularly to monetize whatever they can plunder from the earth, things that they did not create, things that they cannot replace. If we incentivize the plunder of limited resources, natural resources that we are here to steward, we are basically shooting ourselves in the feet. And that, kind of like congressional insider trading, has been going on for too damn long. And the insider trading enables the policy decisions that keep us from, it not only enables the policy decisions that keep us from climate justice, but it enables the political decisions that keep us from having the policy debates over issues like nationalizing the fossil fuel sector. So there are layers of corruption here that insulate each other. I am not afraid of them. I'm eager to build on the 80,000 votes that we won in 2020. The press and its independence is a problem confronting our democracy. It's one reason I'm so grateful for your work and the work of so many other independent journalists and journalists at outlets that are not beholden to the corporate duopoly who are willing to examine the facts and call out the incumbents and hold them accountable. It's something that we as a people share widely as an interest across all the political parties and across all the congressional districts. I'll go back to where you started the interview, that 18% approval rate among members of Congress. We, the people, have done enormous things to make giant leaps forward in securing our rights. This is a time when we, the people, need to show up. If we are a free and a brave people, if this is to be a home of the free, and if it is a land of the brave, I encourage my neighbors to make better choices. And I encourage journalists to show up for work. I encourage Congress to start legislating around the issues that we need to address the future. And since they have proven themselves unwilling, since they have already demonstrated their preference to profit instead of serve, I'm quite eager to offer my neighbors in San Francisco a better choice.
Well, and see, you know, you really hit on something there, because people have to understand across the board, when you basically you divorce a policy from a political party, you know, universal health care is widely popular when it's not necessarily attached to a political party. Once you attach it, approval goes down. Same thing with taking action on climate change. Same thing with debt-free college, with all of these exceptionally progressive ideas. The public does, in fact, want these. And then it becomes so incredibly unfortunate when they go back to the polls every 2 years and say, well, maybe this person will give it to me. Maybe this is something that they want. I mean, folks, it's really simple, and the media plays a huge role in this. You need to go look at their campaign websites, but more importantly for the incumbents, look at their record. You know, go to On the Issues, which is a phenomenal resource to look at how these individuals are voting. And if you see that their votes do not align with your values or what you think needs to happen in this country, you have a choice. You go to the primaries and you put somebody else on that ticket. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, voting down somebody that's been in office for 37 years. Sometimes you have to do, and not just sometimes, you have to do that if you want better things, if you want a better life, if you want to change the world. You can't just keep sending back these people that have proven to you they're not going to do it. And I think, honestly, again, it's actually, what, 35 years for Pelosi. She's proven she's not going to do it, you know. And for another term, another 2 years, the clock is ticking on a lot of these important issues. How many people are going to die from a lack of access to health care in the next 2 years? You know, how bad is the climate catastrophe going to get in another 2 years? How much money? Well, we pretty much know. We're talking about, what, $1.4 trillion at least in the next 2 years on the military budget. We can't afford those things. And they always talk about we can't afford the good things. No, we can't continue to afford the bad things. That is what is costing us so much money.
I could not agree more. Both as a civilization and as a country, is it costing us money? And it's also costing voters and working families money. I want to make this really sharp. We talked before about the corruption of millionaires in Congress enriching themselves by trading stocks based on insider information and putting corporate interests before those of their constituents. It's even worse than that, though. So it's not just a Congress of millionaires enriching themselves through insider trading. Nancy Pelosi has time and time again stood against efforts to increase the federal minimum wage, while time and time again supporting one after another attempt, and most of them successful, to shovel tax breaks to the wealthy, herself and her rich friends. And if you think about policy as a class war, which is basically what has been happening for hundreds of years in this country, a sustained upward distribution of wealth from working people to increasingly obscenely wealthy people who could, you know, eat caviar and the most expensive, drink the most expensive, you know, wine or whatever at every meal their entire lives. They could fly on a Learjet constantly and never even touch the ground. And they could never, through however much they might try, they could not possibly spend all the money that they have accumulated in there in a single lifetime. And with Pelosi, you know, I'm jumping around here a little bit, but when we talked about the insider trading and the $200 million she's amassed, based on her congressional salary, it would take her 1,000 years to amass that kind of wealth, while the minimum wage has not increased in a decade. How many Americans right now are, I live with a roommate. I rent a one bedroom in a two bedroom home in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And many people, certainly in my generation and those below, don't have their own homes. How many people are living in their parents' basement at the moment? How many families are caring for multiple generations, you know, elderly folks who are dealing with healthcare that they can't necessarily afford because we don't have universal healthcare, and maybe kids that are struggling, right? I think many Americans are trapped in a cycle of trying to make ends meet in a struggling system that's nickel and diming us. That system was designed by wealthy people who make policy and are protected by a press that will not cover the issues. And so if you are outraged by Washington, direct it somewhere, and don't just direct it at critique. right? I mean, one thing I appreciate about our conversation is we are both assessing the corruption of the establishment and we're examining alternatives. The key to transition and accountability is to embrace and support alternatives. It's not enough to critique the establishment. You have to build something better to replace it. And that's exactly what we're doing in our campaign by advocating for basic human rights to housing and healthcare and food, which is not complicated. We have the resources for it. Here in San Francisco, there are tens of thousands of homeless people, and we have more empty units than that. And why do we treat housing like healthcare as a commodity instead of a human right? If we treated basic human needs as human rights instead of excuses for people to get rich and for corporations to get rich, we could have a completely different social fabric. People could actually feel secure. They might, in fact, even be able to pursue their aspirations in the arts or the sciences. We could have a renaissance. But we can't at the moment because Washington takes its cues from Wall Street. And that has to end. And there's no more powerful an embodiment of that co-optation than Nancy Pelosi. And for a city where the United Nations was founded, for a city that was a beacon to the LGBT community, not just in the United States, but across the world, for a community that led the free speech movement and the peace and justice movement against the wars in Vietnam and Iraq, I am absolutely convinced that our city deserves a voice in Washington that will stand for our principles instead of Wall Street's.
You absolutely do. And, you know, I want to circle back to something you said, because when you talk about, you know, the system is designed that way, it reminds me of the fact that people don't understand. If you've never struggled, you really have no idea how expensive it is to be poor here in the United States. You know, you can't afford $70 for a teeth cleaning twice a year. So you end up having to spend $1,500 on a root canal and a crown 2 years down the road. You can't afford $500 for car repairs. So you put it on a credit card and you have to spend $1,000 over the next 3 years paying it off. And there's so many, you know, you can't afford to go.
And then your car breaks down again. And what do you do now?
Exactly. You can't pay $100 to go to the doctor. So you miss a serious illness and then you're on the hook for thousands of dollars in treatment. It is so damn expensive to not have money in the United States. And it's only getting worse. And it is because it is designed that way. Wall Street makes huge profits because people can't pay their bills. The banks make tons of money, billions of dollars a year, because you overdrafted. And all of this is designed to continue this cycle of poverty in the United States, while the people who've, you know, increased their wealth by hundreds of millions of dollars, supposedly, you know, representing the people, we go unnoticed. And I think another thing, too, when I talk about how long Pelosi's been in office, or I mention how long McConnell's been in office, people have to understand, too, that's all these years that they're not home. Okay, they're not hanging out in their district every day. They're not seeing what has happened in the 3+ decades they've been hanging out in D.C. for most of the time. You lose connection and you lose touch. And I think that's why we've got to have the fresh faces. We've got to have this turnover, if you will. You know, let people who remember and know because they were there today, they should be the ones representing that district. You've lost touch, Nancy, and so many other politicians in this country. And it's to the detriment of the district itself. And I wish the people in these districts all over the country would wake up to that fact. These people left you behind long ago, and they're not looking back again until, of course, they need your votes. They'll pander to you, and then they disappear again for 2 or 6 years, depending on which office they win.
That is exactly right. And San Francisco demonstrates this pattern precisely. And I want to give a particular example of it. Hunters Point, Bayview, is the site of one of the worst environmental justice calamities in our country. And let's just do this historically. 70 years ago, when we were testing bombs in the South Pacific and then designing and building nuclear bombs to drop over civilian populations in Japan, those bombs were designed and built at the Bayview Hunters Point Naval Shipyard here in San Francisco. When the ships returning from the bomb blast that destroyed the Marshall Islands, or many of them, over the objections of local indigenous communities, returned from those mass human rights abuses, the ships were cleaned in the Hunters Point Shipyard. It's our city's only remaining black enclave. The radiation poisoning there is so severe that people who buy property are forced to sign covenants that deny them the right to grow vegetables out of their yard because they would be effectively radioactive. The breast cancer rates and the asthma rates are among the worst in the world. We are represented, that district is represented in Congress by its most powerful member. And Nancy Pelosi's role on the poisoning of Hunters Point in the black community, the 4% of our city that remains that is African-American, her role in that process was to help engineer the land privatization that then has exposed tens of thousands of people to radiation poisoning, instead of fighting the Navy and seeking accountability, right? And that's just an example. Another one that hits even closer to home, 2 years ago on my block, one of my unhoused neighbors was shot by an off-duty FBI agent. And thankfully, the young man survived. We ended up hosting a community meeting, our campaign did, where he phoned in from his hospital bed and addressed the crowd directly, and we signed up everybody there for cop watch shifts. But the point here is that the only person in the city who could do anything about a rogue FBI agent shooting people was our federal voice in Washington. And as far as I know, she's never said a word about it. And meanwhile, you have an entire community clamoring for our rights. My unhoused neighbors were terrified because they don't have anything that protects them from a rogue cop, right? If you have drunk government agents shooting people running around in the middle of the night, like, and you don't have a home to be inside, that is a terrifying prospect. And Pelosi couldn't care less. Would a right to housing be a higher priority for Democrats if they weren't led by a wealthy landlord herself, right? I mean, there was a bill introduced early in the pandemic by Ilhan Omar that would have forced banks to pay the cost of rents and mortgages during the pandemic, and it never got a vote in Congress. Nancy Pelosi controls the House agenda. Why isn't the House voting on measures to make banks pay the cost of housing and treat healthcare as a matter of right that demands accountability? And, you know, I see there's so many themes I keep wanting to jump to. One I wanted to share, can I share the case study from last night? It's a bit of a sharp digression.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Really interesting for people to hear. So this, I share this in the spirit of offering your listeners examples of things that they might do to help make a difference and hold the corporate establishment accountable. So last night, SEIU, Service Employees International Union, endorsed Nancy Pelosi without any process, without any debate. And the rank and file deserves a chance to hear alternatives. So one of our supporters, who happens to be a member of SEIU, invited me to a Zoom gathering that Nancy Pelosi was speaking at. She's been ducking debates for 34 years, but we had a chance to like get inside the event where she's, you know, kind of hiding from the public to talk to these union members. Now, the union leadership did not let me speak, of course, but I had a chance to post in the chat. It's like a 4-sentence critique, of course, what the rank and file never gets to hear. It ended on "you deserve better, demand it." And just to watch the look on Nancy Pelosi's face as she was reading the chat, that in itself was priceless. But I noticed that it landed because the union leadership then disabled the chat, removed me from the meeting. They ended up bringing me back on. But the point here is that if you're part of a union, hold your union accountable. Don't let your unions become tools for the Democratic Party. They've been that for too long. And that's been an enabling part of this process. The rank and file deserves a chance to hear the alternatives and to participate in endorsement decisions. Now, SEIU denied that to its rank and file. I'm encouraging other unionists to seek democracy within their unions because it's a key, frankly, to enabling democracy for all of us. The co-optation of labor by Wall Street is a longstanding problem, not just in the context of political endorsements, but particularly in the context of, again, entrenching corporate power. And that's ultimately what we need to crack. So, you know, I've shown solidarity with any number of labor unions, dozens over the time that I've been running for office and long before that. And I'm inviting solidarity from labor, not with my campaign, but with your own rank and file's interest and the interest shared by labor both across the United States and certainly around the world to combat capital and to contain Wall Street instead of deferring to it. And the deference of unions like SEIU to the corporate Democratic Party is disappointing. And I'm just sharing this anecdote again. Any member can do that. If you're part of a union and you see an endorsement process happening, or you see an incumbent politician being given a, you know, path to coronation, contest that. And if the union leadership is not open to it, get some alternative voices into the meeting and let them offer the competing perspectives. You can enable the debate that the corporate politicians don't want to have, in the same way that the Farrens enabling, you know, this discussion now that the corporate media doesn't want to have. Everybody has agency. And I encourage everybody to look for where your agency might lie. And if you don't know where your agency is and you have questions or you want to develop your agency as a citizen to help support the future, that's kind of what we're here for. And I'm very eager to speak with people and connect them to networks that can help empower them in whatever way they might be situated.
And you know, this all kind of comes back to another central theme too, and that is don't blindly ever just give your support, you know, to anyone. And that's, you know, basically what we see the SEIU doing in this particular instance. Like, oh, it's Pelosi, we support you. Great. No, I encourage people on both the left and the right, ask when you go to the polls this year, when you go to the primaries this year, not just, you know, in November, go and vote in the primaries, folks. That is equally as important, if not possibly more important. Ask yourself when you look at this incumbent, what is this person doing? Not necessarily for me, but for my district. What is different here? What have they specifically done that has made life better here for anyone? And one of the ways I use that most of all is obviously people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. I direct that message to her constituents all the time, but it does go for people like Nancy Pelosi. You know, the point you're talking about, the radioactivity there. What has she done for that? What has she done for these individuals? And it doesn't matter if it is a Democrat or if it is a Republican. If you ask yourself the question, what have they done for home? And you don't have an answer for it, then I think you just figured out who not to vote for in these primaries, because we send them there and everybody, I know the hyperbole of this, they work for us. But no, they do work for you. And if they're not working for you, do not give them their job back. It's time to let some of these folks retire and replace them with individuals who are going to do the work, not just on the national level with national legislation, but send some help back home as well. Because at the end of the day, that's one of the big jobs of the House of Representatives. That's why committee assignments are important, because you get to help the people back home that way. And a lot of people who don't understand kind of the day-to-day, you know, congressional workings, that part gets overlooked. But they do have the means to help you at home. They're actively choosing to not do that.
It's just a matter of whose water are they carrying. And, you know, that kind of leads us back to where we started with the congressional insider trading. Public service is an obligation to support constituents and we, the people of the United States. And what I see too many of these policymakers in our Congress of millionaires doing is putting their pockets first. And Pelosi's a poster child of that. Again, from the congressional insider trading to the tax breaks for the wealthy, freezing the minimum wage, denying human rights to healthcare or housing or food. There are a million ways in which we are all being structurally marginalized by a Congress of millionaires. That in that class war that has been waged on working people in this country for decades. It's a thing that I had the unfortunate experience of encountering when I was young. My family lost our home to foreclosure when I was 16 years old. I was in the process of graduating from high school. When I was applying to colleges, I didn't realize how bad our financial situation was. I knew things were great, but my parents hadn't really clued me into just how bad they were. So I ended up going to a private college, couldn't afford it. I spent 10 years going to night school to earn my undergrad degree while I was working for a series of all things, Wall Street banks in Chicago. This was in the 90s. So I watched the precursors to the 2008 financial crisis. And when I finally got my undergrad degree, I went to law school to learn antitrust law so I could bust the banks that I'd worked for and our clients. And while I was doing that, happened the war in Iraq and the Patriot Act. And I came out of that alarmed at the constitutional crisis that I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life to fighting. And this entire time I've watched corporate Democrats side with Republicans against we the people. And I'm grateful to see so many people over the last several years start to question more that dominant narrative and to look through the smoke and mirrors constructed by Hollywood and Wall Street around Washington But I see more and more a generation of not just young minds, but I think critical minds across all generations that are looking for better choices, who are concerned about a future that looks, I think, from where we are standing in 2022, often quite hopeless. It doesn't have to be hopeless. Like, yes, the climate crisis is here and it is going to get worse. Let's just be real about that for a minute, right? That's going to get worse. And the pathway of the pandemic has certainly been brutal. The indefinite future for humanity does not need to be one of slow, sustained collapse. We can actually get a handle on this, but it's not going to happen if we keep letting Wall Street make the decisions. And that ultimately is up to us. And I don't even think about this. Just, I appreciate your emphasis on the sort of like benefits that derive or don't to a community based on its congressional representation and, you know, bringing democracy home, because it is ultimately all politics are local. As an immigrant to the United States, born in the UK to a family from Pakistan that was part of a community vilified by a military dictator supported by the Pentagon, I also recognize that politics are also, for better or worse, inevitably global. And that's what motivates my campaign. I recognize the threat to humanity that the climate crisis in particular presents, not just humanity, but life on Earth and the capacity for it. And we cannot defer to a mass extinction machine. And that is exactly what Wall Street and its co-optation of Washington represents. And the future is not here to fight for itself yet. I think that burden falls to us in the present. And I want to make this explicit too. You know, I have had the opportunity to fight for 20 years at the forefront of the movement to hold Wall Street and Washington accountable. But as an individual, you know, I don't have a dynasty. Pelosi has a $200 million fortune. She's the daughter of an East Coast political dynasty. And many press reports have emerged suggesting that whenever she does choose, if she is allowed to choose to retire, they're going to put her daughter in her place. And I'm not any more supportive of feudal aristocracy than I am of corporate capitalism. and the threats to our democracy are so layered and they compound each other. It's so much worse, I think, than people realize. And for those who are tired of getting fleeced, I'm just going to plead for your help. And, you know, whether it's a $5 donation or a couple hours making phone calls or, you know, designing something for us or introducing us to some people in your neighborhood, there's a million ways to support and they don't have to be big, right? I mean, we built our campaign in the last cycle that forced Pelosi to concede six major issues based on contributions. We raised $1.6 million based on the average contribution was $21, right? So, it, you know, nobody has to go bankrupt supporting our campaign. Nobody has to lay it all on the line. I'm happy to lay it on the all on the line. And I have, you know, I've been lied about viciously by an orchestrated party machine. You know, I've certainly taken my share of hits from across the political spectrum, from the right to people who claim to stand on the left and to organizations that claim to stand on the left. And this, you can see in who takes heat, some indication of who is actually fighting for us with a capital U. And I've been fighting for us for decades and I'm eager to continue fighting for us in Washington. And I'm grateful for the chance to share some ideas with your audience.
Well, we definitely appreciate it. So the website is shahidforchange.us. Everybody can go there. That's where you can find out ways to support, as he just mentioned. Also, take the time, go through the issue pages, read these. There's some wonderful, wonderful things on there. And so, of course, Shahid Buttar, this was absolutely wonderful speaking with you today. Thank you for joining us on Ring of Fire, and I wish you nothing but the best in this campaign. And I will say I absolutely hope you are successful with it. So thank you so much today.
Thank you, Farron. I appreciate the chance to be with you. Keep up the great work. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. We've got a great interview coming up with Sohail Mortazavi, but that is for our members. And if you want to get that interview as well as exclusive content every single week, make sure you go sign up at rofpodcast.com. We have wonderful interviews available for our members. So please help support the show. And of course, get access to this wonderful information. Go to rofpodcast.com and sign up to become a member.